Greetings and galactic stridulations, my colossally morphometric listeners, and welcome to this July 2015 Science News Update. I'm the host for this platonically nefarious science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. And so, yet another anniversary is upon us. I've now been doing this podcast feature for 7 glorious years, which is also the age of my son. So I can always track how long I've been at this news thing by simply referring to him. So we are at 3/4 of the way to the 10-year mark. We shall see how much farther we have to go. I swear there are some stories that I have been returning to again and again over the span of 7 years, like last month in the discussion of xenoestrogens and plastics. Even after 7 years, the U.S. government has still not banned BPA or its relatives. Memory and memory erasure has come up again and again. Exoplanets are a perennial favorite as well. I don't know if there are very many of you out there that have actually been listening to this nonsense for 7 years, except possibly Tony Smith. But if you have been, then I salute you. Thank you for the loyalty. For those of you new to this hoary podcast, and that's hoary meaning old kiddies, not the other one, you newbies are in for a treat. First, several listeners emailed me in sympathy for my sleep apnea, and that was very nice of you. Thanks very much for your kind thoughts. A couple of you, namely Kathleen M. Hansen and Ramona Saroyan, decided to ask me a question in connection with snoring and sleep apnea and evolution. Namely, how in the heck did humans evolve snoring anyway? Wouldn't snoring be a bad thing and call down every predator in the area while you were sleeping and most vulnerable? And also, my cat slash dog slash ferret doesn't snore. Why do humans? Okay, first off, you may be making a mistake by assuming that humans started snoring when we were still living in the woods. It's possible that we didn't actually evolve that maladaptation until after we were snug behind walls where we would be safe to relax. So to answer the question, you would actually need to know when snoring actually evolved. Was it early in human evolution or later in human evolution? Another possibility is that you're simply mistaken and that snoring isn't an adaptation at all. It's often a bad idea to be thinking about evolution from a purely adaptionist perspective, since a great deal of evolution is thought to be non-adaptive. In other words, many things have evolved that have no evolutionary advantage at all, or disadvantage for that matter. Snoring probably did not evolve as an adaptation. It's more likely a consequence of our anatomy and physiology. One of my colleagues suggested it may be a consequence of human vocal cords. Another jokingly suggested that Neanderthals may have snored worse than humans and earlier in their evolution and may have doomed themselves because of that. Now, if we assume that snoring is an adaptation, then what advantage may it bring? Will it bring any at all? After a bit of thought, I decided, yeah, it may have. Snoring would give away your position in the woods, certainly, or the forest, but at the same time, it could scare away a predator looking for an easy meal. I have certainly been told that my snoring scares our cat out of the room. So how hard is it to believe that snoring 100,000 years ago was employed to scare away lions and tigers and bears? We snore because it warns other animals not to mess with us, maybe. If you come into a cave and there's a deep rumbling snore coming from an interior, you're probably less likely to enter that cave. I mean, entering is kind of risky. Why do it? And whatever animal is in there could be woken up. So if you hear a loud snoring, the result could be fatal if you enter that dark cave. So snoring could have been positively selected. And by the way, yeah, cats and dogs don't really snore very much, except when they're old. I had a 23-year-old cat who you could certainly hear snoring. That's a lot what she sounded like. Anyway, but there are mammals that are known to snore. And that includes horses and mice, apparently. So snoring might be older than humans. It's quite possible. So let's get back to our first official story of the night, which is there a new DNA base pair? Or a new DNA base, I guess you'd say. Well, Here's a quick story from this month's issue of Nature Chemical Biology. And it has to do with a new type of DNA base that has been found in mice, and in all other eukaryotic organisms by implication. You may remember that there are four standard DNA bases, G, T, C, and A, guanine, thymine, cytosine, and adenine. Well, it's been that way for quite a while, but Dr. Martin Bachman of the Cancer Research United Kingdom Cambridge Institute is proposing a new semi-permanent base that may be found in genomes in addition to the other four. An epigenetic marker known as 5-formyl cytosine may be more than just a transitory chemical state. It may actually help to regulate gene expression. Bachman says that formyl cytosine is stable in the mouse genome and may represent a fifth nucleotide of the DNA alphabet. He says, quote, "It had been thought this modification was solely a short-term intermediate, but the fact that we've demonstrated it can be stable in living tissue shows that it could regulate gene expression and potentially signal other events in cells," unquote. While the function of this modified base, which essentially is a methylated cytosine with an extra oxygen, it remains kind of unclear. Its position within the genome points to a role in gene expression, but what that is not understood. Bachman believes that the chemical modification to DNA is found in very specific positions in the genome, the places which regulate genes. And his group has found that alteration in every tissue in the mouse's body, albeit at very low levels. Bachman found the altered base to be most common in the mouse brain, but even there, it's only present at about 10 parts per million or less. But when the researchers enriched cultures of mouse cells or mouse diets with stable isotopes of carbon and hydrogen, they found no uptake into these particular bases, these formyl cytosine bases, and that suggested that the modification is stable. Bachman concludes, quote, "If formyl cytosine is present in the DNA of all tissues, it's probably there for a reason. This will alter the thinking of people in the study of development and the role that these modifications may play in the development of certain diseases," unquote. And the next story. I was kidding about those Neanderthals, but you know what? Neanderthals really got around quite a bit. If you remember that movie Superbad, there was a character who called himself McLovin. Well, McLovin seemed to originate about 30,000 years ago, and he seemed to be a Neanderthal. It turns out there was a lot more interbreeding between Neanderthals and Homo sapiens 35 to 45,000 years ago than anyone would have guessed previously. Around the same time, Neanderthals disappeared from the landscape, but not before interbreeding with Homo sapiens. Recent research published this June in the journal Nature by Dr. David Reich of the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard has revealed that all non-Africans living today retain a genetic trace, 1 to 3% of the genome of Neanderthal ancestry. And about 40,000 years ago, human genomes would have contained maybe twice as much Neanderthal DNA. So if you are from Europe, well, or Asia, or anywhere except Africa, essentially, you have 1 to 3% of your genome thanks to Neanderthals. Genetic material recovered from 40,000-year-old human bones unearthed in Romania harbor about 6 to 9% Neanderthal DNA, the study reports. Some of the DNA was contained in three relatively large chromosome segments, suggesting the individual had a Neanderthal ancestor a relatively short time before, only 4 to 6 generations back, which means, what, 80 to 120 years previous, which isn't that long previous. Reich and his colleagues sequenced DNA from the jawbone of a skeleton found in Romania in 2002. The remains of the skeleton retained gross morphological features that suggested it was a human Neanderthal mix. So Reich decided to plumb the genome for such a relationship. Although contaminated with exogenous DNA, that's DNA from the outside from other sources, the jawbone yielded DNA that the researchers processed in order to isolate and analyze endogenous genetic material, that's material from the organism itself, in this case, the Neanderthal human mix. The key to isolating out the individual's own genetic material involved bioinformatic techniques that separated out contaminating DNA. They were able to use recent approaches to identify endogenous parts of the genome. In addition to finding the chromosomal segments that suggested a recent mating event between modern humans and Neanderthals, Reich and his colleagues found genomic evidence of an earlier hybridization that likely occurred between the two species. This isn't the first time researchers have identified a human-Neanderthal hybrid. Previously, researchers had found evidence of an older mixture event which occurred in the Near East in what is modern-day Israel. The new results suggest that Neanderthals and modern humans mixed in modern-day Europe. Reich says, quote, "What's exciting about this is that it is evidence that Neanderthal mixture occurred in Europe as well. What seems to have happened is that modern humans moved through Neanderthal territory and mixed with them multiple times through that span," unquote. I love work like this because it's like a genetic time machine. We may not be able to physically go back in time ever, but I think it's so amazing that we can do these types of analyses to tell who was mating with whom more than 30,000 years ago. All right, onwards and upwards. If you could predict when you were going to die, would you want to know? Frankly, I'm not really sure I'd be interested. I mean, I have a good idea because of how my parents and other relatives are surviving the ravages of time, but I have no delusions of being Lazarus Long. I will be very, very lucky to make it to 100, even with the future's promise of amazing medical breakthroughs. I'm more interested in what my quality of life will be in the next 50 years, if I survive that long without getting hit by a truck or eaten by zombies. How healthy will I be if I actually make it that long? However, I know there are others of you out there who would love an approximate prediction of death by old age. Well, for you, Dr. Ian Deary of University of Edinburgh may have an answer in this month's issue of Genome Biology. With the exception of mutations caused by outside sources, genome sequences, well, they pretty much remain constant throughout your life. Yet, how those genomes are regulated does change over time and in response to the environment. DNA methylation is one way a cell can significantly alter gene expression in living organisms. Methylation patterns vary across the lifespan. I've talked about methylation before. And the methylation, the addition of these little carbons, it changes with development and age. And studies have also shown that lifestyle choices and environment can alter these patterns. Jerry's research shows that methylation patterns can actually predict mortality. He states, quote, "This new research increases our understanding of longevity and healthy aging. It is exciting as it has identified a novel indicator of aging, which improves the prediction of lifespan over and above the contribution of factors such as smoking, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease," unquote. Because age-related changes in DNA methylation are well documented, researchers have developed ways to calculate a person's biological age from the methylation pattern. And in the new study, the authors used the comparison between age as predicted by methylation pattern in blood and actual age of nearly 5,000 older people in four large studies spanning 14 years. Using one model, they found a 21% greater mortality risk in individuals whose predicted age based on DNA methylation pattern was greater than 5 years older than their chronological age. This relationship held true even after the researchers accounted for the potentially confounding influences of smoking, education, childhood IQ, social class, cardiovascular diseases, high blood pressure, diabetes. The study concluded that DNA methylation predicted age is an epigenetic clock that measures biological age and runs alongside it, but not always in parallel with chronological age, and it may inform life expectancy predictions. The author tested several variants to determine what could lead to fast-running epigenetic clocks, but found only that women had significantly lower differences between their actual age and age predicted by methylation pattern. Factors such as education and health didn't really show any influence. Deary finished with, quote, "At present, it's not clear what lifestyle or genetic factors influence a person's biological age. We have several follow-up projects planned to investigate this in detail," unquote. Next story. Well, we've had our Star Trek type communicators now for the last 15 or 20 years. Cell phones are now so ubiquitous that we barely even consider their futuristic nature and how they can keep us easily in contact over thousands and thousands of miles. But what about other Star Trek gadgets? Are there hand phasers on the horizon? Anabolic protoplasers? Warp drives? Well, no to most of that. But the tricorder is a bit closer to coming into actual existence. The journal Emerging Infectious Diseases in June had a report from Dr. Dmitry Lopotko of Rice University about a new handheld device that can electronically scan for malaria without touching the patient. The device is a laser scanner that can give an accurate diagnosis in seconds without breaking the skin, just like the fictional tricorder in Star Trek. It works by pulsing energy into a vein in the person's wrist or earlobe. The laser's wavelength doesn't harm the human tissue, but it's absorbed by a chemical called hemozoin. Hemozoin are waste crystals that are produced by the malaria parasite Plasmodium falciparum when it feeds on human blood. When the crystals absorb this energy, they warm the surrounding blood plasma and make it bubble. An oscilloscope placed on the skin alongside the laser senses these nanoscale bubbles when they start popping, detecting malaria infections in less than 20 seconds. Lopotko says, quote, "This is the first true non-invasive diagnostic for malaria. We even managed to use the device to show whether dead mosquitoes were carrying the parasite or not," unquote. Malaria threatens about half the world's population, and it kills about 500,000 people a year. It killed almost 600,000 people in 2013. Existing tests for malaria are already pretty quick, but they still take 15 to 20 minutes to give a diagnosis. And if you've got hundreds of people to test, well, that could take a while. Blood has to be taken, the test has to be conducted by trained personnel to get reliable results, extra chemical reagents have to be used. So not only does it take 15 to 20 minutes extra, it also is much more costly. Lopotko says, quote, "A single battery-powered device the size of a shoebox will house everything associated with the small probe, with no other reagents, facilities, or specialist personnel required. We estimate that a single unit would cost about $15,000, but that one unit could test 200,000 people, potentially bringing the per-person cost of testing from 50 cents to under 8 cents," unquote. Lopotko also says that further tweaks are needed to his malarial tricorder before the probe can become a mainstream diagnostic. For example, it gives a more ambiguous result if a patient has dark skin. Yeah, that's a big thing that you have to fix. Just a bit of a potential pitfall when most of the children who you're going to be testing in Africa account for a majority of malarial deaths, and they all have dark skin. But Lopotko says that he's pretty confident that skin color problem can be overcome by simply switching to a different wavelength of laser. So here is a story from the July issue of the journal The Scientist. I always like to report on scientific misconduct stories, but you will notice that you almost never see, whenever I talk about these things, you almost never see serious punishment on these nitwits who made up their data. This story is a bit different. A former Iowa State University scientist who pled guilty to felony counts of research misconduct earlier this year for adding human antibodies to blood from rabbits to make an HIV vaccine appear more effective than it actually was, he's going to jail. Dr. Dongpyu Han, who was forced to resign from Iowa State in 2013 after that fraud was discovered, is going to be serving 57 months in prison. And he's going to have to repay $7.2 million to the National Institute of Health. Yes, they were the ones who funded his research, and that's how big his grant was. And by the way, I have never come within $7 million of getting a $7 million grant. Anyway, Han said when he was sentenced July 1st, quote, "I deeply regret any and all misconduct. I meant no harm to anyone," unquote. Stiff sentences like these are pretty rare, as I just said, and the guilty parties are usually just subject to fines and prohibitions from receiving further federal research funding. But there have been a handful of instances where the frauds were given jail time for their action, and this is one of them. His misconduct attracted attention last year when Senator Charles Grassley and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Des Moines took the case to a grand jury. And Hahn resigned from Iowa State in 2013 after the fraud was uncovered. Dr. David Wright, former director of the Office of Research Integrity, ORI, which investigates cases of research misconduct among NIH grantees, he told the scientists that the wider benefit of Hahn's punishment is unclear. Quote, "It's questionable how much more is to be gained by jail time. Penalties are normally meted out by the Office of Research Integrity. Being barred from receiving federal funding is usually sufficient to ruin a fraudulent researcher's career." Unquote. So can it get any worse with this schmuck? Yeah, it can always get worse. Although, owing the U.S. government $7 million when you are now despised and unemployable is pretty bad. But yeah, it's worse. According to the story, U.S. District Judge James Gritzner, who presided over Hahn's sentencing, mentioned that Hahn would likely be deported to his native South Korea after serving his jail time in the U.S. Dr. Hahn, I hope you have a very rich, very senile uncle in Korea who likes you an awful lot. Next story. Moose spit? Good? Yes, good. Okay, here is some sticky research that came out of York University, and it shows a surprisingly effective way to fight against a certain species of toxic grass fungus, moose saliva. Published in this July's Biology Letters by Dr. Dawn Bazaly, the paper shows that moose and reindeer saliva, when applied to red fescue grass, which hosts a fungus called Epicloa fescucae that produces the toxin ergovalin. It results in slower fungal growth and less toxicity. Bazaly says, quote, "Plants have evolved defense mechanisms to protect themselves, such as thorns, bitter-tasting berries, and in the case of certain types of grass, by harboring toxic fungus deep within them that can be dangerous or even fatal for grazing animals. We wanted to find out how moose were able to eat such large quantities of this grass without negative effects." Unquote. Inspired by an earlier study that showed that moose grazing and saliva distribution can have a positive effect on plant growth, the research team set out to test an interesting hypothesis: whether moose saliva can actually detoxify the grass before it's eaten. Working in partnership with the Toronto Zoo, the team collected saliva samples from moose and reindeer, which they then smeared onto clip samples of red fescue grass carrying the toxic fungus. They then found that the application of the saliva produced rapid results and inhibited fungal growth within 12 to 36 hours. Bazaly says, quote, "We found that the saliva worked very quickly in slowing the growth of the fungus and the fungal colonies. In addition, by applying multiple applications of saliva to the grass over the course of 2 months, we found we could lower the toxic ergovalin between 41 to 70%, unquote. Bazaly concludes with, quote, "We know that animals can remember if certain plants have made them feel ill, and they may avoid those plants in the future. This study is the first evidence to our knowledge of herbivore saliva being shown to fight back and slow down the growth of fungus. Because moose tend to graze within a defined home range, it's possible that certain groups of plants are receiving repeated exposure of moose saliva, which over time has resulted in fewer toxins within their preferred area." Unquote. Last story of the night is another one of those forensic crime-related stories. I read it in the June issue of the Journal of the Scientist. I think 2 months ago I mentioned a story about extracting DNA from fingerprints to help identify an evildoer. Well, a company called Parabon Nanolabs has actually gone one step further than just extracting DNA from fingerprints. They have entered scary SF territory. How scary? Well, according to Parabon Nanolabs, the DNA left behind at a crime scene may help give some idea of what suspects look like. And they are commercializing that process. Parabon has developed a process that actually predicts the appearance of a person's face based on his or her genetic sequence. Stephen Armatrout, the founder and CEO of Parabon, says, quote, "A sketch artist uses information pulled from an eyewitness to create a sketch. Well, our algorithms are doing the same thing with a genetic witness. with that DNA that was left at the crime scene to create a sketch, unquote. I was more than a little doubtful when I read Armantrout's statement. It just doesn't seem very likely. I mean, I could see how you could predict certain traits, but how do you predict no shape, or no size, or ears, or eyebrow placement, or cheeks? I can go on and on like this. Well, apparently NBC News, who reported on the company, was just as doubtful as me. They put the analytic system of Parabon to the test and sent them a water bottle from reporter Kate Snow. And according to the article I read, the resulting sketch they got from her DNA does not resemble her facial features at all. However, it got her hair color and complexion right, which is exactly what I would have suspected would have happened. According to a press release from Parabon, police are currently using the technology for, quote, lead generation, narrowing suspect lists, and identifying unknown remains, unquote. In one such case, Parabon provided a sketch to law enforcement of a white man with dark hair and light eyes connected to the 1988 murder of a child. Armantrout says, quote, in this tragic case and many like it, we aim to bring renewed hope to the families and friends of crime victims that their loved ones will get the justice they deserve, unquote. Although I remain leery of the technology, I certainly wish him and his company lots of luck. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Keep snoring to scare away the predators. Be honest if you accept $7 million from NIH. Keep moose saliva in your medicine cabinet. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.